Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
Thank you for joining us today on the Social Network Show. This is Dr. J, joined by Jim Nico. And we are talking with Dr. Elizabeth Englander. Now, just over 2 months ago, she was our guest, and you learned about the two arms of the Massachusetts Aggression Reduction Center, the program and research. The program utilizes college and grad students to speak to students K through 12, and the kids they speak to learn skills to reduce aggression from a high-status peer, from whom, amazingly, they learn more effectively than from grown-ups, such as parents and teachers. But at the same time, the college and grad students get experience in the field implementing research findings. Then you heard about two of Dr. Englander's ongoing research studies, which study online and cell phone behavior, one with entering 18-year-olds at Bridgewater State University and another following 40,000 8 to 18-year-olds. I'll review a little bit more of that session at the start of each of today's segments. And now let's get right on to today's show. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Dr. Englander.
Thanks for having me.
And welcome from Jim Nico, too, and thanks for coming back. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
I love the way you start out Chapter 5 of your book, Bullying and Cyberbullying, What Every Educator Needs to Know, which is now available to purchase. And to paraphrase, you point out that in 2010, there were an estimated 112 million episodes of drunk driving in the United States, that according to a report from CDC. But despite the risk and tragedy involved, the authors never recommended that the use of automobiles be abandoned. We would find that absurd, really, as most of our experiences with vehicles is positive, not negative. They broaden our horizons, increase our freedom of movement, and expand our social environment. Is that true of digital technology as well, Dr. Englander?
Absolutely. And I think that it's easy to lose sight of that because we tend to pick up on news stories and other reports that focus on the negative. And I think my research and my work is as guilty as anybody else's in that regard. But the fact is that it's still true that most of the experiences that adults and kids have in digital environments are very positive. And most of the uses of this technology is also very positive. So I think it's a very comparable situation.
Well, in another example, if a child is playing at recess outside and breaks a bone, we're not going to ignore that injury just because most of the kids haven't broken any bones. So
exactly,
that is what we can deal with today. And I notice that you use the term digital abuse. And why do you think that is maybe sometimes more appropriate than cyberbullying?
Well, you know, I think that we're really just beginning to learn a lot more about how people and how kids interact online. And one of the things that is becoming clearer is that a lot of the problems that happen between kids don't really meet the criteria that we lay out for bullying per se. For example, a lot of the problems begin inadvertently with a misunderstanding or something like that, or it begins as a very discreet kind of event where, for example, one child might pass on a rumor, but they might only pass it on to one or two people. And, you know, in the end, it gets forwarded many, many times, and everybody in the school knows, and a whole incident begins. But it wasn't really intended to be that way. So none of those kinds of things really fit the definition of bullying per se. And so, you know, although we use the term cyberbullying, we do it mostly because that's the term that people recognize. But really what we're talking about are problems in digital environments, problems with how kids socialize. And abuse or meanness is probably a better word.
So this may not occur online in the sense of on social network or through email, but a lot of the risk factors are on the telephones, texting, for instance, right? Which would technically, I suppose, couldn't be cyberbullying, but I really think that cyber is beginning to apply to many digital environments. It doesn't matter whether it doesn't have to be on a desktop computer or a laptop. It doesn't have to
right.
be.
Right. Well, the truth is really that what the device that many of us call a cell phone is a mobile computing device.
Mm-hmm.
So the distinction between the device, whether or not what it walks around in your pocket or sits on your desk, is really a minor distinction. The fact is that if you're using digital technology to communicate, then you know, it's all referring to pretty much that system, whether or not it's text messaging or whether it's, you know, posting something on a website or any of those methods.
Okay, so one of the things you deal with is sexting. And what is a good definition for that?
Well, nobody can really agree, actually, on what a good definition is. I think that researchers who are looking at this issue right now, and there's really only a handful of us, everybody is sort of using a different term. So some researchers are looking at any content that has sexuality attached to it. So it could be pictures of people, very suggestive or naked. It could be text or electronic communications like audio that is sexual in nature. Anything like that could be called sexting. In my own research, just for simplicity's sake, what I did is I simply focused on picture exchanging pictures, and
okay.
You know, they had to be pictures where people were completely naked. So I was trying to be very clear so that I could study the issue in a lab setting. But in real life, it really could be a lot of different things.
And so your study and your results really are looking at what I might consider to be somewhat the extreme end, because in mid schools, for instance, it seems like requests for pictures, bra or no bra, would be not a completely nude photo. It'd be a topless photo, perhaps, or an underwear photo.
That's true.
In
my research, I would have counted a topless photo as a nude photo.
Okay.
I
think what many people are wondering is what motivates this. Why would people do this?
Well, I think that primarily there seem to be two major reasons. One reason is when kids are in a relationship with somebody else and they want to share something intimate or private with that person. They want to show the person they trust them, things like that. And so it's sort of a gesture within a relationship. Kids are fascinated by sexuality, so as adults are, really. So it's not so surprising that they would take advantage of technology like this. But it's not always like that, unfortunately. I mean, one of the problems that I bring up in the book is that there's a very substantial proportion of kids who send a nude picture, for reasons, not because they really want to do it in the context of a positive relationship, but because they're feeling pressured or coerced, or somebody has promised them something if they do it. And those are not the right reasons.
Right.
Definitely.
And I found it very interesting that you brought out that many times this is before an actual dating relationship begins. It's a prospective.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Maybe somebody catches wind that of a girl wanting to go out with them and say, well, first of all, let me see a picture.
Right. That's right. And that's not uncommon. I mean, it's not uncommon at all. And we see this both anecdotally in the field with the kids that we work with and in the findings. They're pretty close in terms of their agreement. And, you know, it seems to be sort of a way to, the kids see it as a way to get somebody's attention, somebody that you like. Maybe then they'll be attracted to you and they'll want to go out with you. You know, maybe something's been promised either overtly or sort of implicitly. And, you know, what they really don't see, which is what really bothers me, is that, you know, telling somebody that you'll go out with them if they send you a nude picture is really a form of sexual harassment. And it really bothers me that kids aren't connecting those dots.
Right, to realize that this is not somebody who you would have a healthy relationship with if you got it going. So some of the evidence that you brought out indicated that there was a difference between those who sext and those who don't in terms maybe of depression or substance abuse.
Right. I think all of the problems were more prominent in the kids who were sexting, who said they really didn't want to do it, but they felt pressured or coerced into doing it. So those kids were clearly, you know, they clearly had more psychological issues. But overall, there were some differences between kids who sexted and kids who didn't. Some of them had to do with their comfort with sexuality, which probably makes sense. You know, if you're more comfortable with sexuality, you're probably less intimidated, which meaning that, you know, you could translate that sort of another way and say, well, they were sexually active. They were more likely to be sexually active, which is true. You know, also there were some issues, some elevations and things like anxiety and depression. I don't think it would be accurate to say that every kid who sent a nude picture was emotionally struggling. That I wouldn't agree with that. That didn't seem to be the case. And most of the time, these pictures didn't really seem to cause trouble for these kids, which was sort of surprising to us.
And we hear about the ones where they really have run into problems. And I think we'll take that up in our next section, the risks that sexters are running by doing this sending of compromising photos, you might say. And we'll look forward to your thoughts on that.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
I'm Kelly Keller, an intellectual property attorney specializing in internet law and social media issues. Join me on The Kelly Keller Show right here on the Social Network Station. Together with my guests, we will tackle tough legal problems presented by the ever-increasing use of social media in everyday business. Through dynamic conversations, we will discuss your rights and responsibilities in the new media world so the hard work you have put into developing your brand, business and products does not go to waste. How does the law's response to the social media explosion affect you? Join me on The Kelly Keller Show to learn more.
Now, back to The Social Network Show.
We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Englander from the Massachusetts Aggression Reduction Center at Bridgewater State University. And we last time we spoke with her, she told us about how studying the ways that are being used in digital environments can actually change how people interact, think, and perceive things, such as being in a physically private space seems to contribute to the sense that what you're doing online is actually private. So I thought that was a very interesting way of looking at it. One of the things we need to educate people, not just kids, but everybody, about. Mm-hmm. So back to this section. Elizabeth, we were talking about risks, that sexting may not result in bad repercussions, but it does run a risk and something that could leave one open for cyberbullying. So what are some of the risks that sexting makes one vulnerable to?
Well, there's a couple. Traditionally, what we tend to, or not me personally, but adults tend to warn kids about two different risks. One is the risk that you could actually be charged with a crime, because if you're underage and you send a nude photo, even if it's of yourself and you're sending it willingly, technically speaking, that's a violation of child pornography laws. So, and early on when sexting first emerged, which was maybe 4, 5, 6 years ago, there were a handful of cases that were actually prosecuted. So that tends to be one warning. The other warning tends to be that everyone is going to see the photo and that, you know, you're going to be humiliated forever. And indeed, there are cases where these photos have been passed around, and we've seen publicized cases where kids have been absolutely devastated when this happens. So, it certainly is a possibility. Both of these things technically are possibilities. But one of the things that that we found and that others have also found, David Finkelhor has done some work on this as well, up in the University of New Hampshire, and these risks are actually lower than we think. That, you know, adults tend to look at sexting and say, oh, it's inevitable that it's going to get passed around. Well, it's kind of ironic, but I think it may be common enough today that it's not quite so juicy a photo anymore as maybe it would have been in my generation. So kids don't necessarily pass them all around. And most of the kids that in our study who sexted told us that, to their knowledge, the picture was never passed around.
I want to ask you something. You may be aware we've done shows for over a year now, and one of the most vivid images ever from taking away from the Social Network show is when you talked last time about people being, like, say, an individual, a young girl, for example, sitting in her bedroom on a computer and thinking she's alone when she's exposed to the world in a sense, and even like Sherry Turkle, Alone Together, you know, the metaphorical thing. One thing that very much I'm fascinated, first of all, your brilliance is really refreshing because you see so clearly and concretely in so many ways. One thing that I want to ask you about is, as you know, Carol Todd, I believe you know, is on our board of advisors, and her daughter, arguably Amanda, is probably the most world famous of the girls that went through all the craziness online. But one thing that when Carol flew to Las Vegas and did a show here, one of the things she wanted to clarify was that Amanda never took a picture of herself. She was the picture that went viral and that caused all the problems was taken when she was online thinking she was sharing with her boyfriend. So all she did was take off her top, and the person on the other end who wasn't her boyfriend, the predator, therefore took those pictures as what was explained to us and put those into a child porn room. And, you know, when it got crazy from there. So,
right.
And then the last thing that where I'm going with this is it something else something else you said last time was just really struck me as not only brilliant, but very, very important. And that is when you explained when, like at a birthday party, for example, how parents need to, or guardians, whoever's in charge of that party with kids, needs to curtail rude behavior. I mean, it's very vivid. In other words, it's not okay to not have everybody at the table, or, you know, to be rude. Okay. So if you could address the, you know, what can parents do? In other words, if somebody, some kid takes off their top, they could be photographed on the other end and not even mean it, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, honestly, I think the only way to address this with kids is from a really genuine point of view. So this is one of the things that we try to do with the kids that we work with in schools, is to say, we don't want to go up and say to a child, and I wouldn't say this to my own children either, you know, if you do this, if you take off your top for your boyfriend online, it will inevitably lead to you being, you know, charged with a felony and everybody's going to see it. And that kind of statement isn't going to help kids, because mostly what they're going to do is listen to that and say, well, you obviously don't understand anything, because I know a lot of kids who have done this and none of them have had problems from it. So all it really does is tear down our own credibility. So instead, what we have to do is say, look, if you take this, if you do this, you may not feel like you're taking a chance. You may feel like you're doing something that's very safe, but actually there's really serious risk involved. It may never happen. Nothing bad may ever happen. But if something bad happens, it can be really, really bad. So it's sort of like analogous to wearing a seatbelt. You know, you could never wear a seatbelt and never get in a car accident or never get hurt in a car. That's very likely. In fact, most people, right before we all wore seatbelts, most people drove around in cars all their lives and they weren't killed or maimed. But it's a foolish risk to take, because if something does happen, then wearing a seatbelt is going to be so incredibly protective. And this is kind of the same type of thing. There are risks that are foolish, and you just have to realize that even though it's unlikely anything terrible would happen, if it did, it could be really, really bad.
Well, and this is a departure.
That's kind of how we phrase it with kids. And, you know, when I teach it to my students, the way I conceptualize it for them is I say, think of risk as being, there's different kinds of risk, right? There's like vertical risk, things that aren't so bad but are likely to happen. And then that's horizontal risk. And then there's vertical risk, which is something that's not likely to happen, but if it does happen, it's completely devastating. So what happened to Amanda Todd would be an example of vertical risk. What happened to her isn't likely to happen to other kids, but if it does, it's completely devastating. So we still have to pay attention to it, because, you know, in the end, it cost her her life. And so it merits our attention. Even one life lost is too many.
Well, and what I think is so profound and so important for parents to hear, and what you're saying, is this is the departure from the old saying of, like, I'm sure you'll be fine, you know, just mind your own business and go about your business. In other words, it was always that sort of reassuring people that I'm sure you'll be fine, when there was never any education about risk. And risk, I think, is what makes you so ahead of the curve with this, because if we deal with risk, then they can make a decision, but they've been informed.
Absolutely. And if you think about it, kids are really receptive to that kind of concept. I mean, if you tried, for example, to get in a car today and not buckle your seatbelt, and if there was a teenager or a child there, you're going to get a lecture. I mean, you're not going to get away with that. They're not going to let you do that. They're receptive to the idea, you know, that it's, there are some things that it's dumb to risk. And so really, that's kind of the way I think to frame this. It's like, yeah, it's fun, but there's ways to do, to be intimate with a boyfriend that aren't going to entail something that could get completely out of your control and devastate your life.
Thank you. Thank you. That's risk perception is a deep subject in itself. But you're pointing out that if they know what risks are there, and they're able to do that trade-off in their own mind as far as, yes, if it does happen, it's going to be really, really bad versus, well, it's not likely to happen. It at least gives them some tools to work with.
And that's right. I mean, at least some kids are going to say it's not worth the risk to do this.
Right.
But it's important to be genuine about it. You can't, you know, it's, I really cringe when I see adults who work with kids who say to them things like, you know, inevitably if you take a photo, it's going to get out to everybody. Like, I cringe when I hear that because I feel like all that's happening right now is these kids are sitting there listening and thinking to themselves, this person doesn't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, it's like if you take one drink, you're going to kill half the brain cells in your brain. So
right. That's right. Or what was that movie about marijuana? Do you remember that everybody laughed about in the 50s? They put it out about how, you know, it rots your brain and it turns you into a hardcore heroin addict. You know, one puff and your life is over. And I wish I could remember the name of it.
Well, and Bill didn't inhale, so thank God for that. You know.
Yeah.
We're going to be speaking next about self-cyberbullying, which happens sometimes, which you are calling digital self-harm. And we'll look forward to what you have to say about that in the next segment.
Want to be a guest on The Social Network Show? Email us at guest@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. The only thing I didn't learn in school today is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
Now, back to The Social Network Show.
You are listening to The Social Network Show, and we're very glad you are. We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Englander from Bridgewater State University and the Massachusetts Aggression Reduction Center. And she was with us back in September and told us about how one of the aspects that is surprising to kids and adults is that texting to vent, you might say, to just kind of get something off your chest, oftentimes will intensify rather than diffuse emotions. And there are some scientific brain studies that deal with that. It's called priming. And then, Elizabeth, you also talked to us about gateway behaviors, and one of which is social snubbing. So why is it not important to worry about whether something is technically bullying or not?
Well, the key really with behaviors that are really socially inappropriate, that are put downs or really show contempt or disdain for somebody, which is what we call gateway behaviors. The key there is that it can be really hard to tell whether they're actually being used to bully somebody or not. So if somebody does something really mean to your child online, you really don't know if that's the first thing they've ever done or the 100th thing they've ever done. You don't know if it's part of a long campaign, in which case it would really impact them, or if it's just a one-time meanness. And so if we get really hung up on whether or not something is sort of an ongoing attack like bullying, or whether it's a more, you know, one-time kind of somebody who's just in a bad mood or just cranky at the moment or mad at you. You know, if we get really hung up on that, then you sort of never get anywhere, because it's very difficult to make that distinction. So instead of sitting there and saying to yourself, well, is it bullying? Isn't it bullying? Is it cyberbullying? Is it real bullying? Instead of trying to make those distinctions, what I find is much more productive is just to address the kinds of social behaviors that are problems. So if, you know, your child, for example, is doing something online that is really embarrassing another person, then, you know, then as parents, we should call them on it and say, you know, I don't care if you're doing it as a joke. I don't care if you're doing it one time. I don't care if you're doing it 35 times. You just can't do that. And the same thing in person. So if kids are being really contemptuous towards somebody else, they need to stop that. You know, you don't have to like somebody, but you can't behave in that way towards them, regardless of whether or not you like them.
Okay, so reestablish some standards of behavior. And, you know, honestly, we have to recognize that a lot of times all we're doing is treading water. But if you're treading water, you're not sinking. So whether it seems like the child is responding to that or not, it's important to keep standing firm for those standards.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And sometimes I think that, you know, we worry too much in the moment, you know, about the emotional impact of something. So if you say to your child, you know, I don't want you doing that online because I don't think it's right to do, I don't think you should worry too much about whether or not they agree with you, whether or not they see your point. What you're trying to do is impart your values to them, and the way that you do that is through consistency. So if you consistently say, this isn't right, I don't like it, then, you know, at the very least, if they do it, you know, they're going to feel guilty about it. They're not going to enjoy it, and eventually they're going to adopt your values around it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the ultimate goal, but nothing is instantaneous. We can't make children believe what we believe, you know, instantly. That's sort of not how it works.
It has to
happen over time.
So it's a long-term project.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's go on to the idea of self-cyberbullying. We know that in some of the highly publicized cases, it's questioned whether the bullying online was done perhaps by the person themselves. So let's assume that happens sometimes. What's the motivation there?
Would anybody do that?
Yeah.
Well, just to clarify, too, because I think a lot of people don't understand how this happens. Basically, the way self-cyberbullying seems to happen is that somebody will create a second persona or profile online, and then they will use that sort of second personality online to cyberbully their first or original persona online, and then they will take evidence of that cyberbullying to their friends or to adults to report it.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll draw attention to it. That's a key part of this. And what I found is that most of the time kids do this if they're trying to get the attention of their peers. Sometimes they want other kids to worry about them. They primarily go to their friends when they concoct these things. But the groups of kids who did this were sort of separated into two groups. There was about half of the kids sort of tried it out and then abandoned it. Like they I guess it didn't work or it wasn't very successful. But the other part of the group just did it over and over again, even for them, it largely wasn't very successful. So my sense is that these are probably kids who are really trying to engage their peers, and they probably don't know how else to do it. They may lack the social skills or other things like that. And so they're using it as a way to try to connect with somebody.
So if it's discovered that, that wasn't really a case of cyberbullying, but does that mean we don't need to worry about that? We can just sort of
I don't think so at all. I think that a child who does this is a child who needs some intervention, absolutely. They are going to sort of peculiar extreme to gain some attention and sympathy, and there's something they need that they're not getting. And so they definitely need an intervention. I wouldn't say that you don't have to worry about it at all. And in fact, there was a case just this past summer, I think, in the UK, where a girl committed suicide, and a very sad case where she committed suicide, and she wrote a note saying it was because she was being cyberbullied. And the website reported afterwards that she had actually been doing it all to herself. So I think it's really an indication for kids who do it repeatedly. It's really an indication of, you know, a need, a really strong need, mm-hmm. and something that's really wrong.
So that would be a red flag for teachers, for parents, counselors, and so forth.
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, we don't know much about it, but I think so.
Well, it seems like a reasonable assumption. To go on to another topic, in terms of age, now I know that your longitudinal study of 40,000, which is a great undertaking, it begins at 8 years old. I believe that's third grade typically, right?
That's right.
But by what age have you found that children are immersed in online activity?
Well, just to be clear, it's actually a cross-sectional study. It's not a longitudinal study. I wish it was a longitudinal study, but it's a cross-sectional study.
Oh,
but,
thank you.
What we did is we started with 8-year-olds because I was thinking at that time, and this was back in 2010 when this study began, I was thinking at that time that if we started with 8-year-olds, then we could sort of watch how they developed in terms of their interactions online, and we can still do that, but one of the things that did surprise me was that they were all already online. you know, by 8 years old, these kids were, over 90% of them, were already doing things like online games where they were actually interacting with other people live online.
Okay.
So they were all already there.
So a game is, it does have some aspects of a social network, correct?
Yeah, these games that kids do today typically do have characteristics of social networking. So, for example, you have an account, you may have an avatar, you may do things like chat with other people, you may trade with other people, trade virtual money or virtual things that you accumulate. So there's actually a lot of socializing.
Mm-hmm.
You may have a friends list, and in a lot of ways, it's really sort of an introduction to social networking.
And you found that to start as early as how old, do you know?
Well, you know, in this study, like I said, we started with 8-year-olds, and they were already all there. So, you know, it starts sometime between birth and second grade. My educated guess would be that probably the peak starting points are kindergarten and first grade.
Mm-hmm.
Probably kindergarten.
Well, it is interesting that many adults are amazed and positively amazed that a child 2 or 3 can grab their parent's cell phone and start operating it. And yet,
that's right.
Really, there's not that much to it. I think it's just that, I mean, in terms of skills required, it's an imitative mm-hmm. behavior. And the adults that didn't grow up with that can't imagine being able to do that because there was a learning curve, you know, for most adults. And yet,
that's right. I think it is, and it's also easier for kids because kids are better at adults in terms of they see like patterns of how to use different objects, and adults tend to be very conscious that there can be exceptions. So, like, for example, if I see a key that is labeled a return key on different devices, I might say to myself, well, it does say return, but it could be doing something different on device A versus device B.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not going to be comfortable just assuming that it always does the same thing. Kids don't have any of those caveats. They just look at it and say, oh, it's a return key, and hit it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, since they have no sense of the value of things for the most part, I'm worried about breaking them, damaging them.
You know, that's a very good observation because one of the things that you have to do on computers is be willing to do a trial and error because they very seldom operate exactly the way the instructions say they will. So
that's right. Assuming anybody ever reads the instructions, which in my experience is pretty unusual, actually.
Well, even the most rudimentary. I mean, yeah. if you're learning a new program and the instructor hands yeah. out a series of steps, you can pretty much be sure that there's at least two or three steps that are missing that you really need to know. So you have yeah. to be willing to do that trial and error, which kids are all very willing to do. Okay, well,
absolutely.
I need to ask you some more questions in the next segment about how soon cell ownership starts, how big of a factor that is in risk of cyberbullying and so forth, and just how cell phones are being misused. And we'll look forward to your thoughts on that.
More of the Social Network Show in just 1 minute.
I'm Kelly Keller, an intellectual property attorney specializing in internet law and social media issues. Join me on The Kelly Keller Show right here on the Social Network Station. Together with my guests, we will tackle tough legal problems presented by the ever-increasing use of social media in everyday business. Through dynamic conversations, we will discuss your rights and responsibilities in the new media world, so the hard work you have put into developing your brand, business, and products does not go to waste. How does the law's response to the social media explosion affect you? Join me on The Kelly Keller Show to learn more.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to our concluding segment on the Social Network Show for today. And we're speaking still with Dr. Englander from the Massachusetts Aggression Reduction Center. I'm so proud of myself for getting that to roll right off my tongue like that. You know, last time I really enjoyed the point of view that, you know, sometimes we think, well, if you're being bothered, just turn it off, turn off the phone, stay off Facebook, do, you know. But you had brought out that this is like monitoring their self-image. Just like we want to look in the mirror before we go out the door or occasionally during the day, they want to know what's being said out there for them. And then Jim had another favorite thing, a takeaway from last week, and that had to do with how parents' response really does make a difference.
Yes. So what I wanted parents to hear is I think, and Elizabeth, if you could embellish in any way you want on this, is that you pointed out that a parent could do one of two things, knowing that it is almost impossible to keep their boy or girl off social networks or the technology, whether it be a phone. Okay. So that's pretty futile. On the other hand, the very important point that you said last time about it's still important for the parent to say to the child or the young adult, whatever age group, look, I don't think you should be doing A or B or C because, and you bring up the risks, et cetera, that what they're really doing is they're planting a seed that may grow to where the child may feel differently, think differently, act in a better way. Can you address that just for the parents that or the guardians that may be listening?
Sure. You know, parents, when it comes to kids' behaviors, you sort of can influence it, particularly when you think about things like digital behaviors, which kids you know, can do anywhere. If you tell them you don't want them to have a social network profile, for example, they can just go to a friend's house and set one up. It's a very simple thing to circumvent your parents' rules. But for things like that, you know, we really influence kids in two different ways. One way is by controlling what they do, which is virtually impossible in digital environments today. It's virtually impossible to actually forcibly control what a child does or where they go on the internet today, simply because there's too many devices and there's too many places where they can access the internet. But the other way that they influence it is by beginning to shape what kids' values are, what they see as good or what they see as bad. So, for example, I was presenting to a group of parents, and one of the father raised his hand and said, you know, I think that my daughter is going to just go out and set up an account anyway. I've told her how I feel about this particular social network and why I don't want her to participate. And, you know, but what else can I do? And I said, well, you know, there's really nothing you can do in terms of controlling her. But if you're talking to her about why you think this matters, why you think it's wrong, why you object, what you think is bad about it, then what you're doing is you're giving her a sense of what your value system is. And when kids and their parents are really attached to each other, kids are really attached to their parents, then over time, they begin to adopt all of their values and their feelings about things, or many of their values, I should say, not all of them. So if you want your child to not use a particular social network or to not do a particular thing, like, for example, sexting, then the way that you really can't completely control it anymore, but what you can do is make sure that they understand that you think it's wrong and why you think it's wrong. And if you do that and you do it clearly and you do it, you know, you make sure they understand and maybe you do it more than once, have conversations about it, then over time, it's very likely that they're going to adopt your value about it and not do it. In the short term, they may experiment with it. And unfortunately, today, there's almost no way to prevent that. But in the long term, what you really want is not just to control their behavior, but you want them to understand why you think it's risky or why you think it's wrong.
And internalize those values.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I know that with the older kids, there's a lot of illicit use of cell phones, you might say, aside from the sexting. You mentioned in your book, Bullying and Cyberbullying, What Every Educator Needs to Know, that there was a practice, or is a practice, called cyberbaiting. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, cyberbaiting is a term that was coined having to do actually with something that kids did to teachers, although I suppose you could do it to anybody. And the idea is that you incite or provoke somebody into anger or into like a tirade or a tantrum, and then you record their tantrum on video and you post it online for other people to see. Mm. So cyberbaiting, you know, kind of came to light when kids started to use it against adults, but it's definitely been used against other kids as well, probably much more often, in fact.
Hmm. Well, that's an interesting side alley, you might say, of this whole situation. And that when kids are online, does the number of friends that they have, you know, friends in quotation marks, have an effect on that also? In terms of, is that a risk factor?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the fact is that people think that by setting privacy settings so that only their quote-unquote friends can see things, they think that that makes information private. But the truth is that anybody who views your information online can easily copy it and disseminate it anywhere. So if you have more than, you know, like 25 people who can view a piece of information, there's going to be some risk that other people are going to see. I mean, honestly, there's a risk of anybody, even if one other person can see it, there's always a risk that somebody is going to copy it. The more people who have access to that information, the higher that risk is. But it probably plateaus at a certain number. I don't know what that number would be. But we do know that kids who have many, many friends, really high numbers, are associated with kids who tend to do riskier things online. So there is a certain sense that, you know, if you accept anybody as your friend, no questions asked, then you're probably willing to accept a certain amount of risk in other ways, too.
Okay. Thank you.
Then that would be one of the ways in which this type of risk-taking actually can end up being related to bullying and cyberbullying. Right.
Definitely. The more information you put out about yourself and the more information that people can find and maybe copy or send around, the more vulnerable you can be. So, you know, if you have a really large digital footprint and you have lots of photos and you have lots of information, then there's, you know, there may be lots of ways that that information can be used against you. If somebody gets mad at you or decides that, you know, they want to go after you, you're sort of making it easier for them.
And that whole issue of privacy is sort of concept that's really in flux right now. How we view it that are not digital natives is quite different than those who grew up with sharing, and they seem compulsive about sharing everything. Why would, in relation to that, why would a youngster seek the advice or the opinion of total strangers versus that their friends and family?
Well, I think sometimes it feels safer to do that. I think sometimes that it feels like you may worry about what somebody who you really care about might think, ironically. Mm-hmm. And in a sense that it can be easier to ask total strangers. And despite the fact that I think it's pretty common when kids go after the opinion of strangers to get some negative feedback, I think a lot of times they don't consider that. They just think it won't happen to them, or if it does happen, they won't care. They're misjudging the risk, you know, again, of what they're doing. They're sort of thinking something has no risk when it really could end up hurting their feelings.
So if they post a picture and say, you know, am I pretty or am I attractive or buff,
right,
that picture can be used in who knows how many different abusive ways. That would be.
Absolutely, and there's no way. And commentary, too. If you look at photos like that, it's not unusual for kids to do this, particularly, you know, around middle school, junior high school age. And if you look at, you know, those kinds of photos in the comments underneath them, a lot of the comments are pretty mean.
Oh, yeah.
It's
and
not unusual.
On YouTube, for no reason at all. Nobody's asking, do you like the way I look? They're just telling them.
Yeah, that's true. It's true.
This has been very helpful, and thank you so much for coming on the show again. This has been the second in the Elizabeth Englander series on the Social Network Show, and we look forward to another one in the near future.
Elizabeth, just so our listeners can easily find you, what website would you like them to go to, please?
They can just go to ElizabethEnglander.com.
Okay.
That's
thank you so much.
Enough.
Oh, by the way, the name of your book, we better do that one more time.
Let's Bullying and Cyberbullying, What Every Educator Needs to Know.
And it's available at Amazon right now, correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. Coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on the Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.